The following sermon is presented by Maranatha Bible Church of Comstock Park, Michigan. For more information, go to mbcmi.org.
And then let's open our Bibles to Daniel chapter 2. We've spent the last two Sundays working our way through Daniel chapter 1. We come this morning to our study of this marvelous chapter, Daniel chapter 2, a chapter that really demonstrates for us that God indeed is sovereignly in control of all things and all nations. As you remember, this marvelous book shows us that God ultimately is the one in charge of human governments and nations. And it shows that the greatest conqueror of all, the Lord Jesus Christ, is coming back someday to defeat his foes and establish his millennial kingdom and rule and reign with all authority and all power. Remember that God's people, the Jews, were taken exiled into the nation of Babylon by a pagan, wicked king by the name of Nebuchadnezzar. They were experiencing that because of their rebellion against God and their disobedience to him. And you can imagine that as these Jews are in exile, that this book would have been a great encouragement to them to realize that God has not forgotten them, that he is still in control of even these pagan nations around them, and he is their comfort during this time when they are in exile. It's a truth that we need to remember as well. We're not the nation of Israel, and we're not in exile, but certainly we are a people who live in a pagan land. We live in a lost world, and sometimes we get so wrapped up in our problems that we lose sight of the big picture of human history. We can get so focused on our problems or the problems of the world around us that we forget God's sovereignty and we forget that he indeed is in control of all things. You can just read the news and be easily frustrated and angered by the things that you see taking place in our country and around the world. As we see decisions made by governmental leaders and those in authority, even in our country, we're frustrated by those. We see decisions being made that destroy the family. Decisions made that result in the death of now 57 million abortions, the death of young children before they're born. We can be frustrated by the attacks on religious liberty and the persecution that is rising even in our country against Christians. We see the decisions that are being made in Washington, and we're frustrated by those things. And we're often asking ourselves the question, what's going on? And is God really in control of even this nation? Are we even anymore a nation under God? And then we look around the world, and we see what's taking place around the world, and we see the persecution rising against Christians in other places of the world. We see terror attacks by radical Muslims. We are watching even now the latest events unfolding by ISIS. We see the abuse of power by dictators. We've watched this week the collapse of the Yemeni government as the president has resigned, a great ally in that region in our war against terror. Just a couple days ago, we watched the death of King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, who was also an ally of ours. And so we ask ourselves the question, is God sovereign? And maybe on a more personal level, we begin to ask the questions in our own lives, why do things happen in our lives? And why do things take place in our lives the way that they do? And we're forced to wrestle with the sovereignty of God and the goodness of God. And it is through the book of Daniel that we learn of God's sovereignty. We're reminded as we study this book that this world is not our home, that this nation is not our home. And I have to say at this point, I love our country. Love being an American. I may be one of the most patriotic people. I love this country. And perhaps it was years of military service and seeing what some go through to defend our country and the freedoms that we enjoy, being a part of our armed forces and the sacrifices that are made by so many men and women to protect our freedoms. I love our country. I love this nation. But this nation is not our home. And America is not our salvation. And God is not God is the one who's sovereign over this country. And so our identity is not ultimately in America. Our identity is not in this country. Our identity is in God and in his work through us in Christ. And our confidence is in his sovereignty over the nation. It's not wrong to be patriotic. I weep Sometimes when I hear the song, I'm proud to be an American. I love this song. It's not wrong to be patriotic. But we need to remember that our great hope is not in America. It is in the King of the universe. The one who will ultimately one day return and depose kings and take down nations and replace all human kingdoms with his everlasting kingdom. That's where our hope lies. That day when Christ returns to establish his earthly throne, to rule and reign with all power and all authority from Jerusalem. The day when that kingdom, that millennial kingdom, is transferred into the eternal state, when heaven and earth are melded into one existence upon this planet, where God makes his home upon this earth, where Christ rules and God's presence is upon this earth, that day when heaven is relocated to earth, that's our hope. Our hope is not in this country. Our hope is not in government. Our hope is in the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And it is that message that we continue to see all throughout the book of Daniel. It teaches us that God is running human history, that he is ultimately in control of human history. And the book of Daniel has two primary messages. Number one, a message of judgment. And number two, a message of consolation. It is first and foremost a book about judgment, that God is coming to defeat and finally overthrow all Gentile rulers and all Gentile nations. That day is coming. That's the first thrust. The second thrust is it's a message of a consolation and hope, written to God's people who are exiled in a foreign land, and he's writing to them to give them hope and about the future deliverance that they will experience through his care. Now, if you remember, back in the first message on this, we said that the structure of Daniel actually reflects those two purposes. We said that there are two primary divisions, chapters 2 through 7, chapters 8 through 12. And chapters 2 through 7 are written in Aramaic. Chapters 8 through 12 are written in Hebrew. Why? It's because chapters 2 through 7 are God's message to the Gentile kings that ultimately one day they will be overthrown. It's written in Aramaic, the language of the people, the language of the Gentile nations at that time. So it makes sense that God would write his plan for the Gentiles in a language that they would understand, the language of commerce, the language of international business, the language of the day, the lingua franca. Makes sense. Chapters 8 through 12 describe God's plan for the nation of Israel. It makes sense that he would write those sections in Hebrew. And that's exactly what it does. What was concerning to the Gentiles was written in Aramaic. What concerned the people of Israel was written in Hebrew. Now, as we come this morning to chapter 2, we begin to see the introduction to us of God's plan for the Gentiles. Now, as I said in the first message, we said that this is a chiastic structure. Stick with me for just a minute. You can imagine an arrow that looks something like this. And a chiasm is basically a literary structure that begins to point the emphasis to the middle of the section. So what you have in chapters 2 and 7 are up here, 3 and 6 are here, 4 and 5 are the point of the arrow. This is how these chapters are structured. In chapters 2 and 7, you have God's instructions concerning four world empires, four kingdoms that show God's control over them. Now you move in a little bit further. You see God in chapters 3 and 6 talking about deliverance. In chapter 3, we see his deliverance of Daniel's friends from the burning furnace. In chapter 6, we see God's deliverance of Daniel from the lion's den. Now you move in a little further. Chapters 4 and 5. So you see what's happening? 2 and 7 are parallel. 3 and 6 are parallel. 4 and 5 now are the point of the arrow. And the point of chapters 4 and 5 is God's judgment upon the wicked Gentile nations. This morning, as we come to chapter 2, we begin to see the main thrust of this first section explained: God's sovereignty over the Gentile nations. And in this chapter, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon at that time, has a dream, a vision of a great statue or a great image. And if that slide is up there, you can see what it looked like. That was the dream. That was what he saw in his significant dream, which Daniel is then going to interpret for us. It's a marvelous section. And as we go through this morning, I want you to see a couple twin truths that go through this section. I want you to see first a faithful man, and I want you to see a sovereign God. It is those two themes that we're going to see developed all throughout this section, starting in chapter 2. We're going to see the marks of a faithful man and his sovereign God. I want to show you 6 points We're not going to get to them all today, so you got to come back next week. Number one, here we go. Point number one, I want you to see first the unsettling dream. The unsettling dream. Daniel chapter 2, verse 1. It says, "Now in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream." Actually, he had dreams. "And his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him." Here Daniel sets the stage for us, and he shows us the events that were taking place at the time that this dream occurred, these dreams occurred. It says, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, if you have your thinking caps on, you will remember that there's an issue here. And the issue is this, that Daniel was under re-education for 3 years. He and his friends were taken exile in that first deportation. And it says in Daniel chapter 1 that they were there being re-educated and retrained for 3 years. Look at verse 5 of chapter 1. "The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated for 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service." So Nebuchadnezzar had set out a very specific time, 3 years, for their education. Look at verse 18 of chapter 1. "Then at the end of the days which the king had specified for presenting them, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar." So they went through the three-year training. Now you have a problem here in Daniel chapter 2, verse 1. It says, in the second year. Shouldn't that say the third year? If Daniel took 3 years to go through his re-education process, why doesn't it say the third year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar? You need to know that there's a problem. And the way we solve that is by understanding that Daniel is writing from a Babylonian perspective as it relates to time, not a Jewish perspective. Had it been written from a Jewish perspective, it would have said a third year. But it's written from a Babylonian perspective, and here's why. Listen, in the first part of the king's rule, it's not considered the first year. It's called the accession year, the year that he ascends to the throne. It's part of a year. It's not a full year. We know that Nebuchadnezzar came to the throne in 7 September 605 B.C. It was the day his father, Nabopolassar, died. It was that day that Nebuchadnezzar ascended to the throne, 7 September 605. The remainder of that year was still considered the rule of Nabopolassar, not Nebuchadnezzar. That's part of his accession year. It doesn't count. So the first year of King Nebuchadnezzar, the first full year, actually constitutes his first year, and it's the second year then that these events take place in chapter 2, which is actually the third year of King Nebuchadnezzar's rule, but by Babylonian time reckoning, it's only called the second year. So I know as you're reading this, you're all wondering why that was the way it was, so now you know. These are the events. These are the situation concerning which Daniel finds himself interpreting this dream. Now notice verse 1. "Now in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. And his spirit was troubled and his sleep left him." I want you to notice in verse 1 that it says Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. Plural. Not singular. Plural. He had multiple dreams, or it's possible that he had the same dream over and over and over and over again. We don't know exactly which one it was. It's possible that he had several different dreams and there's one that stood out to him, or it's possible that it was the same dream occurring over and over and over again. I lean towards the latter because Daniel interpreted one dream. As we see in the remainder of the chapter, it was one dream that Daniel himself provided an interpretation to. Let me tell you a little bit about dreams. In the ancient Near East, dreams were considered to be part of the revelation of the gods to the people. And so those people placed a lot of emphasis upon dreams. They felt like those gave a glimpse into what lay ahead, and so they believed that the gods often spoke through dreams. And so in order to really understand what the gods were saying, it was of critical importance to have those dreams interpreted. So the kings of those days would assemble for themselves a group of wise men or scholars that would be available to them to interpret those dreams as it relates to their future king and kingdom. Nebuchadnezzar was no different. He was a king who had assembled for himself a staff of diviners, a staff of supposed wise men whose job it was to interpret the significance of events like this. As a footnote, people often ask me, what about dreams today? It's a question I actually get asked quite often. What do you make of dreams today? Is God telling us something in our dreams? Well, certainly the first place we need to start is by recognizing that God has used dreams as a means of his revelation. You don't get very far into the scriptures until you realize that, yes, God did indeed make himself known and his plans known at times through dreams, which were revelations. Back in Genesis chapter 20, God chose to reveal himself to a man named Abimelech. You remember Abraham and Sarah? Abraham said, she's not my wife, she's my sister, which was a half-truth because she was his half-sister, but she was also his wife. And it says in Genesis chapter 20 that God came to Abimelech in a dream of the night and said to him, behold, you're a dead man because of the woman whom you've taken, for she's married. God communicated through a dream. Remember Jacob's dream. Jacob had a dream about a ladder going to heaven and angels coming up and down the ladder, and God used that dream to communicate to Jacob the fact that he has a future, that his promises to Abraham would be fulfilled in Jacob, and he was to go back to the land that he had come from. Remember Joseph's dream about how his brothers and father and mother bowed down to him. God communicated his wisdom and his future plans through Joseph's dream. And how about Pharaoh's dream? He learned about the famine that would take place one day through a vision or a dream of skinny cows and skinny bad ears of grain. So certainly God communicated through dreams in the scriptures, even the New Testament. As you come to the New Testament, we see Joseph, the earthly father of Jesus, being told what to do in dreams. He's told in dreams to take Mary to be his wife and to flee to Egypt. So certainly has God communicated through dreams? Absolutely, he has. But we need to understand, listen, that these are periods of revelation. Those are times when God is revealing himself and disclosing the scriptures. So the question is, what about today? Do our dreams mean anything today? And here's the short answer. No. They don't. We don't live in periods of revelation today. We don't live in the age in which God is revealing to us in his extra-biblical revelation. We live in a day when the canon is closed, when the Bible is complete. There are no additional books being added to the scriptures. There's no additional special revelation being given today. So you shouldn't be a person who makes much of your dreams. You say, what are they? I don't know. They're just things you're thinking about. That's really what dreams are. They give you a window into the things that you're thinking about during the day. So essentially, the things that you're wrestling through and thinking through, the things that you're processing during the day, oftentimes find their way into your dreams. It's your mind's way of kind of processing what's going on. That's all they are. So don't make too much of them. I love what Spurgeon once said. Someone asked him about dreams and visions. He says, quote, what if you did see an apparition or a dream? What would that prove? Why, it would prove nothing except that you were in an ill state of health and that your imagination was morbidly active. That's all it is. It's your brain's way, your mind's way of processing truth and information and things that are happening in your day, and at times it's just a morbidly active imagination. Okay, so don't make too much of it. Regardless, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. This is a dream in which God actually communicated revelation to him. I believe it was a recurring dream, a dream that occurred over and over and over again. It says in verse 1 that he had these dreams and his spirit was troubled and his sleep left him. This was a scary dream. This was a nightmare. This was something that so troubled his soul that when he woke up in the morning to unbutton his pajamas, he was shaking with fear. He was fearful, apprehensive, agitated, so agitated, in fact, that he couldn't sleep over what he had seen in this dream. We know from the end of the chapter, or close to the end, that it's actually a dream about the future. Turn over to chapter 2, verses 28 and 29. I want you to see that as Daniel begins to engage the king on this issue, he tells him that this was a dream about the future. Look at Daniel 2, verse 28. However, there is a king in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. This was your dream and the visions of your mind while you were on your bed. As for you, O king, while you're on your bed, your thoughts turn to what would take place in the future. And he who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place. These were dreams about the future. These were prophetic revelations about what God was going to do in the future as history unfolded. Well, Nebuchadnezzar's pretty scared. What does this mean? So he calls his cadre of advisors. Look at chapter 2, verse 2. Then the king gave orders to call in the magicians, the conjurers, the sorcerers, the Chaldeans, to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king, and the king said to them, I have had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to understand the dream. He calls in the people that he thinks are going to be able to disclose the meaning of this dream to him. And I want you to notice this different list of people that he calls in. He calls in every possible wise man in his cadre of spiritual advisors. He calls in the magicians. He calls in the conjurers. He calls in the sorcerers. He calls in the Chaldeans. He's looking for any and every possible means by which he would be able to understand the meaning of this dream. He calls in the magicians. Now, don't think David Copperfield here. These magicians were men who studied the astrological movement of the stars, and they tried to discern what was going on in the universe through star movements. It's kind of an occultic activity. And then there are the conjurers, those who used spells and incantations to communicate with the spirit world. These were also astrologers and stargazers and prognosticators and people who would be the ones today who would go look up their horoscope. There were sorcerers, those who practiced witchcraft with herbs and charms and potions. They talked to the dead. And then there were this group called the Chaldeans, and this is a term that can be used either to refer to the ethnic people of Babylon or to refer to some sort of prognosticator or spiritual advisor. And the term is used here in the latter sense in verse 2. It's referring to those soothsayers or those wise men in his government that are supposedly able to give him spiritual advice. They're the religious gurus of the day. So you have magicians. You have conjurers, you have sorcerers, you have Chaldeans. And what Nebuchadnezzar is doing is trying to find every possible resource to bring some meaning to these dreams. This is his brain trust. He's assembled them together with all their occultism, all their demonism, all their human wisdom, all their attempts at trying to discern this with their palm reading and crystal gazing and astrology and tarot card reading. You know, you name it. They're trying to use these methods to try and discern the meaning of this dream. It's a pretty impressive array of experts, isn't it? And you need to know that in that day, this was a significant practice. In fact, there were whole libraries with massive amounts of volumes dedicated for the primary purpose of interpreting dreams. Because they believed the gods were communicating through these dreams, they had a whole list of books, a whole assortment of books that had a list of the events that could occur in dreams that would then be able to tell you in what combination they occurred what the future was. You imagine, that has to take a lot of books. Because you have a bunch of possible scenarios here. So they had book after resource after manual of these possible scenarios that could occur as a result of knowing what details occurred in your dreams. So the idea was you go, you tell them what your dream was about. You tell them the specifics. You tell them the details. And they would go back and they would study their books and their manuals. And they would be able then, after some time, to tell you what the dreams meant. This is what's taking place. Now, on a side note, you may wonder, why is God revealing himself and the future events through a pagan king? Make sense? Doesn't God normally reveal himself through his people? Doesn't he normally reveal himself through his prophets, through those who are his nation of people who be called out of Egypt? You have to remember the setting. Israel has apostatized. Israel is really no much different than Babylon itself. They're filled with idolatry. They're filled with paganism. They're really not that much different than Babylon itself. And so as they're taken captive and brought into exile, it begins what is known as the time of the Gentiles. Jesus referred to this in Luke chapter 21, verse 24. He says, they will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. The times of the Gentiles began at this moment, and so it makes sense to us that if God is going to reveal himself about the times of the Gentiles and the future Gentile kingdoms, it would come through a pagan Gentile ruler, and that's exactly what we see. So here's what's happening. This is the unsettling dream that Nebuchadnezzar has. Number two, I want you to see the next part of this. I want you to see the unreasonable demand. The unreasonable demand. It occurs in verse 4. Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic. By the way, this is where the Aramaic starts. Starts in the middle of chapter 2, verse 4, and goes all the way to the end of chapter 7. So the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your dream to the servants, and we will declare the interpretation. So Nebuchadnezzar assembles this group of spiritual advisors, and he says, I have a dream, I don't know what it means. And they say, okay, great king, tell us. Tell us what it is. We're up for the job. We're willing to take a stab at this. Just tell us the dream. We'll go consult our manuals. Things get real interesting at this point. Verse 5. And the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the command from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you will be torn limb from limb and your houses will be made a rubbish heap. Nice guy, that Nebuchadnezzar. But if you do declare the dream and its interpretation, you will receive from me gifts and a reward and great honor. Therefore, declare to me the dream and its interpretation. Now, you need to understand that in that day, the protocol was you tell the details of the dream to the spiritual advisors. They go research. They come back and say, this is what it meant. So this is not following protocol. He pulls a fast one on them. And he expects them to tell him not only the interpretation of the dream, but the actual dream itself. Huh. I want you to notice in those two verses, verses 5 and 6, that the phrase, the dream and its interpretation, occurs three times. Nebuchadnezzar's adamant about this. The king answered, verse 5, and said to the Chaldeans, the command which from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you'll be torn limb from limb. Verse 6, if you declare the dream and its interpretation, you will receive from me gifts and a reward and great honor. Therefore, declare to me the dream and its interpretation. You see, he's pretty adamant about this. Three times he says, listen, here's how it's going to work. You're going to tell me not only the interpretation, you're going to tell me the dream itself. If they wouldn't do it, they would be torn limb from limb. Their houses would be razed. And if you didn't think Nebuchadnezzar would follow through, think again. You remember just a few years before this, he had a man by the name of Zedekiah who he had placed on the throne in Israel in his absence. He had him, had his eyes plucked out. He had Zedekiah's sons killed right before his eyes, before he plucked his eyes out. And then he bound him and took him to Babylon. You don't cross the king. Zedekiah learned the hard way. And these magicians and conjurers, these spiritual advisors certainly understand that he's not bluffing. He will follow through on this threat. Now, he doesn't exactly say, Daniel does here, why the king wouldn't tell the actual dream. He doesn't tell us why. So we're left to speculate somewhat about why the king chose not to reveal the details of the dream. Here's a couple possibilities of why he chose not to. One is that he forgot it. That's possible. I mean, think about it. You have dreams at night, and when you wake up in the morning, you can kind of remember, you know, I had a dream, but don't know what it was about. Been there? A number of years ago, I was at a seminar at NASA in San Jose, California, and part of my job as an aviation physiologist was to teach pilots and air crew members about the role of fatigue and fatigue countermeasures in an aircraft. It's a fascinating seminar. And at one point in the seminar, they had gone through a number of principles on dreams and sleep physiology. So just some fascinating things about sleep and dreams. And so you may need to know that the first part of your night of sleep is physical rest. The second half of your night is mental rest. So you can sleep 4 hours and still not feel rested, because physically you might be, but not mentally. And you may also be interested to know that your dream stage occur only at the REM stages of sleep. You go down deep, there's no dreams, you come up in REM stages, that's where you dream, you go right back down. And so that's how you dream. You dream at those REM stages. Here's the deal. You only remember the dreams that you wake up out of. So you can sometimes remember that you had some sort of dream, but you don't remember what it was. And the reason you don't remember is because you don't wake up out of that dream. So these are some of the things that we learned at this course at NASA. Well, that's a possibility here as well. It's possible that Nebuchadnezzar just doesn't remember the details of the dream. He remembers something happened. He remembers that he dreamed something. He just doesn't remember the details of it. But there's another possibility here, and I think it probably makes more sense. It's this. He doesn't trust these guys. He doesn't trust them. He is skeptical. Now, Nebuchadnezzar's a pretty smart guy. Remember, he built the hanging gardens, one of the natural wonders of the ancient world. Remember, this is a smart guy. And so I think what you have here is a king who's very suspect of these hocus-pocus people. He's a little skeptical of how they do what they do. He doubts their honesty, their sincerity, their capability. He thinks they're a little devious. He thinks they're a little phony about what they're actually doing. And so I think he actually refuses to tell them the dream. He doesn't trust them. He demands that they disclose what could only be known by supernatural revelation. Well, these guys know that they're in deep kimchi, because we've got a problem on our hands. How in the world are we going to interpret a dream that we don't know what the details are? So they kindly asked, verse 7. He answered a second time and said, "Let the king tell the dream to his servants, and we will declare the interpretation." See what they're doing? They're trying to coax him. Oh, come on, king, just tell us. No deal. Nebuchadnezzar is undeterred. He sticks to his unreasonable demand. He even accuses them. "You're just trying to stall for time." Look at verse 8. The king replied, "I know for certain that you're bargaining for time, inasmuch as you have seen that the command is from me is firm, that if you do not make the dream known to me, there is only one decree for you, for you've all agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation is changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, that I may know that you can declare to me its interpretation." He doesn't trust them. He thinks they're lying. He thinks they're devious. He thinks they're characterized by telling him all kinds of misleading and wicked things, and now he's getting angry. Now the king of Babylon is getting very upset, and these wise men better come up with a dream, and they better do so quickly. So they ask a third time. Verse 10. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, "There's not a man on earth who could declare the matter for the king, inasmuch as no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this of any magician, conjurer, or Chaldean." Huh. I think they just betrayed themselves. Does he have a reason to be skeptical? Absolutely. They just admitted. In a sense, they admitted to Nebuchadnezzar's skepticism of him. This is a candid confession that despite all their incantations, all their magic, all their astrology, all their attempts to contact the dead, they can't receive supernatural revelation. They admit it. And so in their exasperation, they utter what may be the most profound statement in this chapter. Verse 11, "There is not a man on earth who could declare the matter for the king. There is no one else who could declare it to the king except God's." And that is a theologically accurate statement from the lips of pagans. They're right. "There is not a man on earth who could declare the matter for the king." You're asking the impossible, and that is a loaded theological statement spoken by pagan men, and they're right, because there's no one on earth who can do what the king demands. You see where this is going? Because there is someone who knows The God of heaven knows how to interpret this dream because he gave it to him. And so you can see that there's a setup taking place here. There is an occasion where the circumstances are being set up for God to insert his man, Daniel, into this situation to glorify himself and demonstrate his sovereignty. Well, the king is unmoved. And now he's really ticked. Look at verse 12. Because of this, the king became indignant and very furious and gave orders to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain. And they looked for Daniel and his friends to kill them. And there you get a little glimpse into life in Babylon. Oh, it's glitzy, it's glamorous, it's wonderful on the outside. It's a pretty cushy place to live in the most powerful nation of the world at that time until the king gets angry. And angry he is. He's in a foul mood, and he overreacts, and he issues a decree to kill everyone, kill all the wise men. Well, Daniel and his friends are apparently not there. They're just trainees, right? They still got their training wheels on as wise men. They're not there in the court. But the judgment fell on them. And so here you have the situation. The gloves are thrown to the ground. Daniel and his friends are included in this edict to kill all the wise men. Can you sense the crisis? You sense the crisis of this situation? How's God going to resolve this dangerous situation that Daniel and his friends are going to do? What's he going to do? Remember I said this is a story, an account about a faithful man and his sovereign God? Watch this. Number three. The unflappable Daniel. I love this. We've seen the unsettling dream. We've seen the unreasonable demand. Number three is the unflappable Daniel. And God, in his sovereign plan, has set up this entire circumstances in order to display his glory, to display his sovereignty, and to demonstrate the mark of a man who is faithful in the midst of a crisis. Tremendous. God has sovereignly orchestrated all these circumstances in order to interject Daniel into this situation at just the right time. What you're about to see is a man who is made for a crisis. And you can tell a lot about a person in a crisis, can't you? In fact, you want to know who you're really like? See how you react in a crisis. You want to see what kind of metal you're made of? See how you react in a crisis. You want to see what kind of character you possess? See how you react in a crisis. Because what you have in a crisis is it puts pressure on you. And what comes out of you in the midst of a crisis demonstrates who you really are. And what you're about to see is a man with a death sentence on his head in the midst of a crisis demonstrate his faithfulness to God. I want to show you three characteristics of Daniel that are going to emerge from this section. First, he was filled with wisdom. This is not on the slide, so you might just want to write these down. He was filled with wisdom. Look what Daniel does. Verse 14. Then Daniel replied with discretion and discernment to Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard, who had gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. Here's Daniel, who is suddenly thrust into this situation, and he doesn't panic. And he's not frustrated. And he's not without hope and in despair. Verse 14, he replies with discretion and discernment. Your version may say with wisdom and discretion. Literally with good counsel and with good taste. Here's the mark of a man who is characterized by wisdom. And in this crisis of a situation, in this very difficult set of situation that he finds himself in, suddenly he's thrust there, and what emerges is calmness. He doesn't panic. He replies with discretion and discernment to Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard, literally the captain of the king's slayers, the king's executioners. This is the guy who was in charge of the people who would go out and kill the wise men. Here's Daniel calmly responding with wisdom and discretion and discernment. Why? Because he knew whose God was on his side. He knew what God had gifted him with. He knew what abilities God had given him. Go back to chapter 1, verse 17. Daniel knew what he was made of. He knew what God had done in him and through him. He knew how God had honored him for his faithfulness. Look at chapter 1, verse 17. It says, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. And Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. You see, what takes place in chapter 1 actually sets him up for chapter 2 to demonstrate his faithfulness to God and display the sovereignty of God in the midst of his circumstances. He knew these events were under the sovereign control of God. He knew this didn't take God by surprise. And in the midst of this crisis, he banks upon the sovereignty of God. And so he asked to see the king. Amazingly, Arioch lets him. Now keep in mind that Arioch had just been sent by the king, Nebuchadnezzar, to go kill the wise men. And Daniel suddenly appeals to him and says, could I go see the king? And Arioch, and God sovereignly allows that to take place. Verse 16, so Daniel went in and requested of the king that he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation to the king. This is tremendous. Because what did Nebuchadnezzar accuse the other wise men of? Stalling. He accused them of wanting more time. Look up in verse 8 of chapter 2. It says, the king replied, I know for certain that you are bargaining for time. And here's godly young Daniel, 17 years old, an apprentice. He walks before the king of Babylon, who is at this point foaming at the mouth in rage, ready to hack wise men to pieces. And he says, O king, I can declare the interpretation if you just give me some time. Shows Daniel's character. Man of great wisdom, a man of great boldness, a man of great courage, a man of great discretion. And by God's grace, Daniel finds favor in the eyes of the king. Again, a demonstration of God's sovereignty. Because just a little bit before, he's raging and ready to kill the wise men, and suddenly Daniel comes forward and requests more time, and God gives Daniel favor in the eyes of Nebuchadnezzar. Perhaps Nebuchadnezzar remembers Daniel and what he was like. Go back to chapter 1, verse 19. The king talked with them, and out of all of them, not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. And for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in all his realm. Daniel had a good reputation. And I think Nebuchadnezzar remembered what he was like. He's filled with wisdom because he trusted God's sovereignty. I want you to notice, secondly, that he was marked by prayer. He was marked by prayer. So here's the situation. Daniel has approached the king of Babylon, the most powerful man in the then known world, and he asked more time to go and declare the interpretation to the king. Now put yourself in his shoes. He's 17. And he doesn't know the dream. He has no idea. He's just asked for something and promised something that at this point he doesn't even know about. Imagine the walk back to his house. Daniel, what have you done? I've just promised the king something I'm not sure I can deliver. Would God really help me? Would God show me? Will he reveal this dream to me? Will he enable me to stand before this king and reveal his dream and his interpretation? Look at verse 17. So Daniel went to his house and informed his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, about the matter so that they would request compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery so that Daniel and his friends would not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. I love this. They went back to their houses and they pulled out their manuals and started reading the stars. Is that what it says? They went to this house and 4 young teenagers got on their knees and prayed to the God of heaven. What do you do in a crisis? What do you do when you're in crisis? You go consult all the worldly wisdom before you bow the knee? Or is your first response prayer to the sovereign God? This must have been some prayer meeting. This must have been some time of prayer as these young men were on their faces before the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, asking God for, what does it say here? Compassion, mercy concerning this mystery. You see, when you're convinced about the sovereignty of God, it will drive you to dependent prayer. Right? When you are so convinced that God is in control of all circumstances, your first gut reaction will be prayer. Not surprisingly, God answered. Presumably, the young men prayed for a length of time. Then they went to bed. Because it says in verse 19, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. You see, when you trust God's sovereignty, you can go to bed and you can sleep at night. During that night, God revealed to Daniel the meaning of the dream and the dream itself. What a contrast. These false Babylonian gods, these men of magic and astrology and sorcery who studied the heavens but didn't know the God of heaven. And here are four young men on their faces seeking the God of heaven for wisdom. Daniel was filled with wisdom. He was marked by prayer. Thirdly, he was characterized by worship. He was characterized by worship. And I want you to see how Daniel responds. As God gives him the answer to his prayer, look at verse 20. Daniel said, "Let the name of God be blessed forever and ever. For wisdom and power belong to Him. It's He who changes the times and epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to the men of understanding. It's He who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with Him. To You, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for You have given me wisdom and power. Even now You have made known to me what we requested of You, for You have made known to us the king's matter." Here is a young man who not only is filled with wisdom and not only marked by prayer, he is characterized by worship, because when his prayer is answered, his first response is wonder, love, and praise to the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. What do you do when your prayers are answered? You just say, "Yep, all right, got it, let's go on." Or do you bow your head and you bow your hearts in worship and praise to the God who answered your prayers? Look what Daniel does. Look what he does. Look what he does. He acknowledges the character of God. Verse 20, he praises God for His wisdom. That's His omniscience. And he praises God for His power. Verse 20, wisdom and power belong to Him. That's praise for His omniscience. That's praise for His omnipotence. Look at verses 21 and 22. He praises God for His sovereign control over all the nations. It is He who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. That's praise for God's sovereignty, and Daniel gets it. He understands that this God who he's worshiping is truly the sovereign God of the universe, and every king and every nation in existence owes its existence to God Himself. He praises God for the fact that He has revealed these things to him. Verse 22, it is He who reveals the profound and hidden things. It is He who knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with Him. That's mercy. That's grace. He's praising God. And I want you to notice that Daniel is exalting God for His character. And he just marches through one attribute of God after another. Omniscience, omnipotence, sovereignty, grace, mercy, compassion. Mark it down, friends. Here is a young man who has sunk his life into the character of God. This is a young man who knows God. This is a young man whose life is defined by a profound understanding of the character of God. And listen, if you're going to endure a crisis, you better know God. You better have a firm conviction on what he's like and what his attributes are. You better have a firm conviction about his sovereignty, about his omnipotence, about his compassion, about his grace, about his wisdom, about his omniscience. And the best way to prepare for a trial and a crisis is to get to know God now. Because when the pressures of life pressure into you, what comes out is what you know of God. Friends, this is what made Daniel the man that he was. A high view of God. A deep dependence upon him, a heart of confidence in God, a trust in his wisdom, a trust in his sovereignty, and a firm hope in him to answer prayer and provide for his needs. Do you have those same convictions? You see, this is not about, are you a religious person? It's not about, do you go to church? It's not about, have you had some experience? Do you know God? Number four, the unflinching declaration. Remember I said this is about a faithful man and his sovereign God? Number four, the unflinching declaration. Armed now with the answer to his prayer, Daniel sets out to talk to the king. Verse 24, therefore, Daniel went into Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and spoke to him as follows, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me into the king's presence, and I will declare the interpretation to the king. You see, when you know that God is working for you, and you are firmly convinced of the sovereignty of God, you can be a man or a woman of courage. And here's a 17-year-old young boy who demands, who declares, take me to the king. Verse 25, so Arioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence and spoke to him as follows, I found a man among the exiles from Judah who can make the interpretation known to the king. And the king said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? You see, he's after both. He wants both. He's not caved and he's still demanding the same thing. Is he able to tell me the dream and its interpretation? Verse 27. So Daniel answered before the king and said, as for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, conjurers, magicians, nor diviners are able to declare it to the king. However, now I'll underline this, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. This was your dream and the visions in your mind while on your bed. I love that. There is a God. That's confidence. And when you understand the sovereignty of God, you are able to make certain, forceful declarations like that. Verse 29. As for you, O king, while on your bed, your thoughts turned to what would take place in the future. And he who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place. But as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me more than in any other living man, but for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king and that you would understand the thoughts of your mind. Daniel won't take credit for it. Daniel won't take credit for this. He knows where that knowledge came from. He knows where that wisdom came from. It came from the God of heaven. And he says it is he who deserves all the credit. So here you have the account of a faithful man and his sovereign God. It's obvious just from this far into Daniel chapter 2 that the God of heaven is vastly superior to all Babylonian false gods. And I wonder this morning, do you have a confidence in God's sovereignty like Daniel? Are you a man or a woman of faith, of dependence, of trust? You see, when you sink your teeth into the character of who God is, no crisis will shake you. And you are able to stand with confidence before kings of the world because of your certainty in the character and confidence of God. It's tremendous. And a passage like this should drive us to know God so that we can worship Him accordingly and so that our lives would demonstrate faithfulness in the God that we worship. Father, this is a tremendous text. Tremendous glimpse into the life of this godly young man who 2,500 years ago took a stand, whom you've awarded greatly and honored greatly because of his firm conviction in your sovereignty and your goodness. Or I know there's some people here this morning who are struggling with your sovereignty, struggling with the events that they find themselves in this morning, the various circumstances in their life where they're left to question, God, why? Lord, let us learn from Daniel. Let us have a steadfast resolve to stand firm, anchoring our life on the character of God as revealed to us in the person and work of Jesus Christ. Lord, may we sing now with confidence, all we have is Christ, because that is the truth. In God's name we pray. Amen.
You've been listening to a sermon presented at Maranatha Bible Church in Comstock Park, Michigan, where we exist to display God's glory, declare God's truth, delight in God's Son, and disciple God's people. No part of this digital file may be reproduced or distributed without prior written consent. For permission, go to mbcmi.org.